Hi, this is the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman. I am so delighted to be joined today by Sloane Crosley. Sloane is the author of the novel The Clasp and the essay collections Look Alive Out There and the New York Times bestsellers I Was Told There'd Be Cake and How Did You Get This Number? A frequent contributor to the New York Times, she lives in Manhattan, and her new novel is called Cult Classic. Hi, Sloane.
Hello. Welcome to your podcast. No, thank you for having me on. Very excited. Hello.
Yay. I'm so happy to have you here. And I don't normally like to start a podcast by talking about someone else's book, but I feel like you might have strong opinions about this. I remember a book came out a few years ago, and it was called Marry Him, The Case for Settling for Mr. Good Enough.
Is it more of a comment? That's the question.
Yes, that's the question.
Okay. Now that you have invoked the name of this title, I do have a vague recollection of some kind of piece in Vanity Fair about it. And perhaps a controversial piece in the style section where people were up in arms about maybe the cynicism of it. Obviously, I've never read it. So obviously that title is either self-help or like the most ingenious loss, like Laura Kipnis title I've ever heard. but I understand why you're asking, because so much about Cult Classic, the novel, is about the heroine learning the positive aspects of settling, that it gets a bad rap, that there's a way to settle, as in figure out what you really need. Mm-hmm. And then there's settling as in letting the things that you really want go. And I don't believe in the latter. So I'm still a little bit too much of a romantic for, I shouldn't say anything though. I haven't read the book. Maybe it is the nonfiction companion to my novel.
for the sake of this podcast, let's say it could be. I think I got defensive because I got this impression that the audience was, you know, I was the target audience. So this had to be,
had you just gotten married or were engaged to be so, or?
No, I was still single. So it had to be.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And there was this idea that New York City women want it all. They're too picky. And they're not realistic about things.
Sorry, I'm laughing because the amount of realism that is steadily thrown into your face every day living in the city in arenas that extend far beyond romance. Just you get up and you get out of bed and the city's like, all right, this is cute. Let's see if you can handle this. You know, I mean, I almost got pissed on today in the subway on West 4th, but not intentionally. It was just sort of a circular naked motion that a lot of people almost got pissed on today.
I
was
no.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like, you know, the idea that New York City women are prone to not understanding realism. I mean, I understand why people think that, not just about New York, but about urban areas in general, that we have so much choice and we have so much stimuli and therefore we have short-circuited ourselves out of having a normal life. And, you know, Esther Perel, I am not. So I don't know, maybe people are thinking about this, but yeah, in defense of all formerly single New York ladies, we're really working with what we've got. And we're really trying very, very hard. And so I like you, resent the idea that somehow we are deciding somebody has bad breath or snores or doesn't have a good enough job and we're dismissing them out of hat. That's ludicrous.
And I do feel like, and Lola, your heroine, kind of embodies this.
Yeah.
That there is a narrative that you get into if you're a single woman in a city for long enough, and that becomes such an important part of your identity.
Absolutely. I was just, I was with a friend recently who's Scottish, really, really Scottish. She's from the Shetland Islands. And she was, I was telling her about a situation from years ago with a guy. And she asked me what had ever happened with that guy. And my sort of glossing over of events was saying something like, oh, I didn't have enough space for XYZ. Some sort of emotional, you know, thing. And she just cackled at the sky and said, that is the most American shit I've ever heard in my life. Where, you know, she's like, do you know how many people in my hometown are like, he's got teeth and he doesn't, like, you know, beat you, and he's nice to his mother and he helps old ladies across the street and he's not, you know, drunk. Like, but at the same time, it's like, but that's the thing, is you sort of, and this character very much in the novel too, I mean, it is, she's such a deep mess and a deep commitment phobe. And there's so much about her that is different than me. I mean, that happens with everybody who writes fiction that is remotely autobiographical, which is weird because there's so much wacky stuff that happens in this book. To say it's autobiographical is like that autobiographical novel about a spaceship. but it's like, she is me, but I mean, she is, sorry, rather, she can edit that as at will. She's not me, but what she does have is this sort of like ping-ponging feeling of sometimes adopting the rhetoric of pickiness, of this thing that you're told all the time, and thinking, you know, there's a scene where she's at a bar, she looks down the length of the bar and sees a guy, you know, with a backpack, he looks pretty smart, he's reading a book, he's drinking a Fernet, I don't know what that means, but she's like, well, why couldn't I just mate with this bozo, you know? And I absolutely have thought that, but I have to say, I don't think that's specific to dating or New York. I think everybody has had a moment where they've cracked and done something extreme after having been so careful.
Mm-hmm. And Lola is, you get to show such a wide variety of the kinds of relationships that one can have through Lola. Tell me about the concept of the novel, which in the book, a character describes it as, or maybe Lola does, a Christmas carol, but with ex-boyfriends, which I found very helpful to wrap my head around it.
She actually, I wouldn't normally correct you on a line I wrote, but I do think it's worth it, because I think someone says to her, advises her to think of what she's about to go through, like a Christmas carol. And she says, yeah, by way of The Exorcist.
Oh, yeah. That's an important point. That's so important.
I wouldn't normally, you know, be like, oh, my precious words. But no. Basically what happens is she's sort of offered something that I think, hopefully, if there's a debate in the readers have about the book, is whether or not you would do it. Whether or not you, if offered the same thing, would do it. And, you know, without spoiling it too much, she has a former mentor that's become sort of her best friend. I made her 37 so she could have a little bit of a life, so people could have evolved from different positions into the ones they are now and be firmly where they are now without confusion. So she used to have a lot of sexual tension with this guy, and it's truly gone. You're not wondering, like, are they going to get together? Right. Or at least if I've done my job, you're not wondering, are they going to get together? But, you know, he basically offers, because he's started was essentially an upscale Soho housey kind of mind control cult out of an abandoned shul on the Lower East Side.
As one does.
I mean, let it be the funniest book about a mind control cult and an abandoned shul that you've ever read. It's probably not even. But anyway. So basically the sort of crux of it, and the machinery that takes off throughout the book, is that if she steps within a certain radius of that point, she will probably run into a former flame of hers. And that can mean a lot of things. You know, that's over the course of her whole life. Sometimes it's a long relationship. Sometimes it's a brief encounter. And then we see, without spoiling it, whether or not it ruins or does not ruin her current relationship. And I would do it, but not because I don't think it's hell. Like, that's what's strange, is a lot of people, I'm noticing already this sort of fascinating, at least to me, obviously, feedback of whether or not people think this is an obvious thing to do, an obvious scenario, or a living hell. And for me, I would just be so curious about whether or not it worked. my curiosity would override the emotional fallout that was coming.
I love that. And yeah, I do feel like it's immersion therapy of the most uncomfortable kind.
Yeah, it's meant to be. It's meant to be. I mean, I think there's, you know, it's so funny. So, you know, the FSG marvelous marketing team who have done a pretty good job. And, you know, I used to work in publishing, so I think I'm probably a pain in the butt to impress, mm-hmm. and I'm very impressed. But they will sometimes bat around words like mystical, or they don't really say magic realism, because if anybody is familiar with the roots of that and how you're not really supposed to co-opt it, it's probably FSG. They have a good sense of literary history. But they, you know, this idea that there's this sort of wackadoo, for lack of a better term.
That's the right term.
Yeah, sort of juggernaut that hits this sort of literary comedy of manners. They keep talking about it in these terms that it's like, oh, and this strange thing happens. And I think, I don't know if I've lost my mind. I don't know if this is what hopefully makes the book effective, is that I need to be part of the brainwashed, or one of the brainwashed. But I truly believe that if I had the amount of money that this organization in the book has, I could put you or any listener right now, and someone you do not want to see, in the same restaurant tonight, and it would actually cost me about a fifth of what it costs in the book. And it's just, I'm like, this is marketing. This is not, you know, sort of black magic.
I love this answer. And I want to know a little bit more then about like subliminal advertising, suggestion, yeah. persuasion.
I mean, don't we already know? I mean, the thing is, haven't we all read enough articles in The Atlantic to know that, like, it's not that we're being sold products, we are the product. You know, it's really, I just don't think it's that hard. I think that the amount of times I look at my phone while watching TV, well, you know, the very things I tell my niece and nephew that I'm sort of appalled when they do. But it's like a real, like, it's really, they should re-up that 80s commercial about weed, where the kids, like, I learned it from watching you, Dad. Mm-hmm. Like, where did you get this? And I just feel like they should just do the entire PSA in the same sort of grainy 80s outfits, but with the phone. So I just feel like it wouldn't be that hard if, you know, this organization allegedly has a former NSA member, a early employee of a very popular search engine, lawyers, people who
IDF
with Instagram algorithms, a member of the IDF. See, the thing is, it is at its core a book. It's a comedic novel. It's meant to be entertaining. So at a certain point, like when I think about the fact that I said that a former member of the IDF worked there, I mean, I was just like, it's IDF because it's not M6. Like, it just, I was just sure. throwing, it's intentional, that sort of part of it. I mean, that really the heart of the story is, without sounding too hokey, it is about sort of a philosophical or sort of intelligent angle on dating and romance and the friends we made along the way. You know, it really is about those characters, but the more, I guess, I wouldn't want this used, this word, the following word used about me, but I'll use it about me. It's like your mama jokes, you know, zany, the more zany elements of the book. I had a lot of fun with not knowing exactly how it would work, but also feeling like that space, you know, that a reader might experience, the sort of trust me space. What's in the gap between what I'm saying and what is possible in real life? Feels very simple. You know, it's not alien abduction, it's not time travel, it's not an invisibility cloak where you're like, how exactly does this work? It is just hyper media manipulation and power of suggestion.
Yeah, it's it could happen.
Yeah, it probably is happening. It's probably why we're talking right now. It's not because I have a book out, it's because I'm meant to see something in the background of your Zoom.
And so I, it's true. Like, you can, I can tell how much fun you had creating this kind of culty organization. Tell me a little bit about the basis for it.
I would say that while it might be one of the cultishness, and for fans of the NXIVM documentary, buy a different book. But I would say the cultishness of this novel is so prominent and so sort of outward facing, even in the title. But it really came as a tool or a container to create this character and to create this group of characters about their old friendships and their sort of ill-defined friendships and the dynamic between them, and to put, you know, when there's, let's say, five central characters, like to put the actual main character, Lola, really through the ringer, and explore how much of her dating life she has gotten wrong, how much it was not really about her. There's a whole lot of, just when you think you know who the center of the book is, you don't. And I think that, but I needed it. I was avoiding writing about that kind of thing. Even my language right now, that kind of thing, romance, you know, love, the thing that makes the world go round and sends people to war. The aspects of ourselves that I just had kind of self-ghettoized and you know, into text messages and to thinking I shouldn't write about these kinds of things, because as it is, I write a tremendous amount of narrative nonfiction. I think I can say tremendous. It's like, you know, probably 100 plus essays in my life that have the word I in them. And I get maybe six of them have been about men or romance or dating or relationships. But it doesn't matter. To the world's eye, I get the sense it's more like 60%. And so I think I was trying to avoid doing it for so long. So I thought, how do I, this is a long, long walk off our short pier. It was a long way to get there. But I thought, how do I do this in a way that's sort of hopefully original and interesting and has plot and is a vehicle for something that is a little more shiny, I guess, than a bunch of people sitting around in a bar in Brooklyn talking about their lives.
Yeah. Another line, and correct me if I have it wrong, but that really stuck out to me is that Lola is thinking, like, there are so many other things going on in the world, and yet I couldn't pass a Bechdel test with myself.
I'm like, I was so happy that you latched onto that.
The shame of that.
Yeah, such a shame. Well, also, I can't imagine when that, I don't remember when that comes sort of within the narrative, like just from a pure page count perspective. But yeah, at a certain point, I don't think what's funny about it is she does seem like someone who's obsessed with her past, but really it's almost a chicken and the egg thing. Like her former mentor, this man Clive, has chosen to shine a spotlight on this aspect, or what he perceives as a broken aspect of her life, an inability to make decisions, to make commitments, to choose wisely. And so what's funny about it is that she is sort of disgusted with herself, because I think before the book started, she wasn't like this. In my mind, you know, people always ask when a novel ends, you know, what do you think happens to these characters? And I do think about that, but I also think about what happened before it began. And I don't think she was quite this crazy before Clive/I made her this crazy.
Yeah.
And it is crazy. I you know, I'm sorry to, you know, throw around the C word when it comes to a woman, especially when it comes to something as genuinely insane making as dating in New York. But yeah, she becomes a sort of portal has opened for her to answer all of her obsessions, for her to scratch that itch. And every time she does that, she gets closer to, it's like a drug. You know, you get that temporary hit, but then you wake up sort of hungover the next morning thinking, oh my gosh, I can't pass a Bechdel test with myself. This is all I'm thinking about. So that's also a way of, I guess, commenting on that kind of genre of fiction within mm-hmm. within a book that's actually practicing in that genre of fiction.
I love that. And yeah, I think it's, I can't imagine anyone who hasn't done some light stalking on social media and then felt kind of shitty afterwards.
Are you feel, well, because it's like, there's almost a sort of version of you, you know, when you're done doing your horrible deeds, you could almost feel it within yourself going, you like that? You feel better about yourself? You're happy now? Like, you know, what have you, because even if you find nothing, it sucks. If you find something, it sucks.
Looks even worse, yeah.
And most likely, if you find something, it's the wrong thing. And then it becomes disproportionate in size to their life, to your life, to your memory. I mean, there's a bit where she talks about, you know, text exchanges or going through old text exchanges and that strange phenomenon of things, you know, words that were supposed to become memories become emotions again. They become reanimated and that person isn't even there. So they're not even their words. You're not in conversation with them. They are artifacts of who they were. It's almost like I have any writer who's been copy edited. And maybe you make some sort of intentional choice. You decide to capitalize something. You decide to do something weird with an M dash, whatever it is you decide. And the copy editing department is going through correcting them. And so the first couple of times you think, oh, no, that's not, I meant it. It's fine. It's not a big deal. And then by page 50, you're almost angry as if they are in the room and have not been listening to you, but they're not in the room with you.
They haven't gotten that.
When you're thinking, didn't you hear me? I've said, I've repeated myself so many times. Stet, 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 stet. And, you know, it's not, that is the experience. It's the sort of the editorial version of the experience of reading old text messages, which I'm happy to say that, again, major difference. I don't do that. This is my girl who does it.
I've never done it either.
No, I mean, I think the only time I've done that personally is by accident, because what I do is I keep a lot of text messages so I can find people's addresses for cards or when I need to go to their houses. So I look up, because I'm too lazy to add, this is sort of ridiculous to explain, but I'm too lazy. It's not about the book. I'm too lazy to add it to my contacts. So I'll just look up the word address. And at some point, a friend of mine has asked for my address or I've asked for theirs. And that's how I find out people's addresses. And sometimes that will lead me down sort of a, you know, a primrose path, but with like dead primroses.
I love this productivity tip.
To things I should not see. It's really good because it's really good for people. It's like an ad for a piece of software. I'm like, are you too lazy to add your friends' addresses to your contacts? Well, have I got the solution for you?
But I do love the metaphor of being copy edited, because the ability to say stet and mean it seems like a skill that one has to learn.
Wait, what do you
mean?
And
it might even have to do with closure and what closure might be.
But what do you mean to say stet and like to say stet up for yourself?
To say, no, I meant to do that.
Yes. Yes. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, exactly. And I think that a lot of the pressure she feels and a lot of the, I mean, listen, the book's primary reason for being is to be entertaining. But if there are lessons that I have snuck into it, it's not just to capture. I mean, obviously I think humor comes from observation and exasperation and I mean, what more fertile ground is there for such things than dating, you know, the opposite sex. But I do think that there is something that she, I wouldn't take a lot of love lessons or life lessons from Lola. But I do feel like she comes to this idea that the pressure to, it's even said both at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book, that the pressure to find an inciting incident of why am I like this? You know, why are other people moving on with their lives and why am I stuck? That pressure might have been the inciting incident. That pressure to you know, you don't have closure unless everyone you've dated before the person that you're in love with is trash. You don't, you know, that's less pronounced. People don't really put it that way. I'm sure most people listening to this would object, but there's just a way that the other thing that she learns is that it's okay to let the door swing open. You don't have to slam it. And the second she gives herself a break from feeling like, I think about all these people. I think about all these roads not taken, or as she puts it, the boats I didn't get on, or the boats that just sort of passed me by. Is that bad? Is that bad, bad, bad? And I think, and it, for her, it is. It is a sort of poison that seeps into the root system of who she is and into her actions. But she learns how to kind of modulate it. I keep on bringing up drugs as an analogy. I don't know what's wrong with me. But it is almost like you know when you can touch stuff, and that's recreational, and it's interesting, and it makes, you know, it's like a sort of amplifies your life like salt does to food. And you know when you're gonna have a heart attack and it will kill you. You know, and so I think what Clive does is give somebody, in a way, it's like her overcoming that addiction to the past, which is a dramatic example, but it's just like, I think Clive basically gives her this drug that she can't resist taking. But then she does manage to pull herself out of it in mysterious, non-spoilery ways.
Yeah, no, we won't talk about it.
Hey guys, I want to tell you about a product I'm using literally every day. I started taking AG1 because, just with everything going on in my life, I am really bad about consistently taking vitamins. The best part, it doesn't taste like it's super healthy. It's kind of a mild tropical taste that I actually look forward to each morning. So what's in this stuff? In one delicious scoop of AG1, you're absorbing 75 high quality vitamins, minerals, whole food sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day right. Special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy, recovery, focus, and aging. All the things. Which is great for someone like me who's always on the go, especially with all my running. It's really important that I'm getting my daily source of vitamins. But just because I'm so scatterbrained and organized chaos, I just completely forget, unless I have something that just really makes it straightforward to get everything I need. And AG1 is lifestyle friendly, whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free. And the best part, because while maybe I don't say I'm a healthy eater, at the same time, I really do focus on what I eat, that the fact that it contains less than 1 gram of sugar, no GMOs, and no nasty chemicals or artificial anything while still tasting good is really important to me. And the extra benefit is it supports better sleep quality and recovery. It also supports mental clarity and alertness. And that's because Athletic Greens uses the best of the best products based on the latest science with constant product iterations and third-party testing. And best of all, it only costs you less than $3 a day. You're investing in your health, and it's cheaper than your cold brew habit. You're investing in all-in-one nutritional insurance. And because I said I really do care about where the things I consume come from, Athletic Greens is a climate-neutral certified company. In 2020, AG purchased carbon credits that supports projects protecting old-growth rainforest, as well as donating to organizations that help to get nutritious food to kids in need, including No Kid Hungry here in the U.S. In 2020, AG donated over 1.2 million meals to kids. And right now, you can reclaim your health too and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. Just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is giving you one free year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Maris. Again, that is athleticgreens.com/Maris. Take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
But I also love that because you have a character obsessed with her past, we get to have real fun nostalgia for New York City.
Yes.
Well, decades ago.
Oh, the fifth lady, New York City. Always goes down smooth.
The buildings,
the buildings, they sure are tall. They sure are tall. There's so much concrete. There is a lot of nostalgia for New York. But what's weird about it, it didn't seem like nostalgia when I wrote it. So I handed in the first draft of this book, I handed in the rather inauspicious month and time of March 2020.
Ouch.
Yeah, whoops. But I also felt, what's interesting is I thought, oh, there's going to be a whole wave of novels that come out around the time my novel is coming out. And I think some did maybe before. I think we got too skittish about the sort of bottleneck of publishing and what would happen, and some combination of, will there be printing presses and will the zombies be running them? You know,
you still don't know, really.
You're like, why are you acting like this is over? Yeah, so these genuine questions we all have. And so I feel like, I thought, oh, this will be interesting. There'll be a whole group of sort of pre-pandemic books. And I think there some have happened, obviously, but not about New York that much, at least I haven't really seen. So it's not like I was consciously avoiding the pandemic or consciously thinking, oh, this is New York where we used to run into each other on the street. I mean, the world of this novel would be impossible in our recent world. It's entirely based on public places, on facial recognition. Like it is literally, it's so, and now it's like it slipped back in, or hopefully did, just in time for us to have nothing to be nostalgic about. You know, the city is obviously different, but it's quote unquote back. Do you think so? Maybe I'm wrong.
According to our mayor, it is.
Oh my God. Am I aligning myself with the mayor?
No, that's, I would never horrific. Imply that. I think it's interesting because the city may be back, but I am not in a position anymore to know. Okay. And maybe that is part of the nostalgia, right?
You have a small kid, small child.
No. I'm, you know, older. I'm not trying to like do all that.
But you know what's funny is so much gets swept into the dustbin. Like, I feel like this idea that there's all these cool parties happening in a warehouse somewhere, like people's apartments and all that stuff. And there's sense of it so much in New York, and in the novel. Both. And it, you know, it takes place in a quote unquote cool area, which is, you know, the Lower East Side and Chinatown. But I feel like I think it's like an easy thing, at least for me, to say, oh, well, I don't know anymore, you know, post-pandemic. I don't know. I was still pretty old before the pandemic and like sort of deeply uncool. Like cool stuff hits me. It's like a whirling dervish or like an animal where occasionally like whacks its tail in my face. And I'm like, wow, I can't believe I'm at this party with these people and this thing. And then it won't be true for like a month. So I don't know.
Fair enough. But I did just love even just the listing of names of bars that are long gone. Yeah. And again, that's more to do
with New York. I'm sorry, that nostalgia. You mean like, I thought you meant the more it was a long deviation.
No, I mean that's part of it for sure.
Yeah, but you mean like when there's a point where it's about, you know, it definitely talks about New York in the early aughts, in the 90s. There is a point in the novel where she has a relationship with someone when she's an intern in New York and he's a intern for Habitat for Humanity, and they write these incredibly emo emails to each other, you know, that only exist now in the mind of Sally Rooney. You know, they're just like incredibly long, and she describes New York during its theme park phase. So it was like Idlewild, which featured seats from a DC-10 beauty bar. Also in San Francisco, shout out to the beauty bar in San Francisco. All that stuff, you know, the Corova Milk Bar. Like, we don't have the theme of New York City bars right now is, I'm gonna bleed you dry. So they're so expensive. We used to have sort of, you know, tropical bars, all that stuff, tropical.
I sometimes like to talk about the early days when I was in publishing, and you could go to happy hour in Midtown and spend $5 and get two drinks.
Oh yeah, totally. And you would spend, and you would get to see a lot of like cop beat reporters who worked at like the Daily News, sort of like grizzled, but very harmless gentlemen.
Yeah.
Yeah, not so much anymore. Now everything's a threat and it's expensive. I sound like a 90-year-old lady.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And a last theme I want to touch on before I ask you for books. You also managed to make this book, which is mostly a romantic comedy of manners. It's a great comment on media and the evolution or devolution of where we are now.
Thank you, because that is definitely like a D plot if this was a pilot of a television show, but it's I have a soft spot for it. Yeah, all these characters used to work for a magazine that is called Modern Psychology, which is maybe the least creative part of the book. It's pretty much Psychology Today, except it's folded and it folds. And that she now, you know, the main character now works for the Culture Vertical, I can't speak, at a website called Radio New York. And just her job, which doesn't totally exist, but I get it sort of exists in like the BuzzFeed form, where her job is to basically not so much be like a content farmer, but to try to create original content out of other people's lists and articles about other people's podcasts and lists and articles. And I think I call it the Lloyd Dobler nightmare for the new millennium, you know. And I just, but it's what's weird about it is, I think the one thing that I probably got wrong, just because I didn't even attempt to get it at all, is I'm sure the kind of bond that these characters feel because they worked in an office, putting out a magazine, putting the magazine to bed, you know, because it's a psychology magazine or was a psychology magazine, you know, they would stay up arguing about articles about arguing, you know, it had this sort of like snake eating its own tail thing. And it was or echo chamber, this incestuousness. And I think I'm sure that exists in the workplace now too. Maybe not now where, you know, people either aren't going into work or they're hot desking or whatever they're doing.
Right.
But I think that is a little bit maybe of my own nostalgia, having worked for Random House over 10 years ago, maybe creeping in there a little bit, you know, talking about eating a bunch of salad in plastic bowls that's sort of warmed by the Midtown sun is like very New York publishing or old New York media or Condé Nast, you know, to me. But it's I didn't want to sort of just, you know, shake my hands and think, oh, you know, things aren't as they used to be. So part of the reason why I like that thread in the book is that it's positive. There's sort of an instant acceptance of how things have changed, but they have kept how much they truly love each other well after the magazine has folded. And so I do think that inadvertently that D plot becomes sort of actually, you know, that background, a pretty big part of the love story that Lola experiences, because without sounding too hokey, it really is also about her friends who, without ruining it, are given a lot of the latter half or the ending of the book.
Yes, they are. So, this was so fun. And
thank you for your questions.
Probably tell that this book is so funny and delightful. Before we go, please recommend some books for us.
I would love to do this because at the aforementioned day job, I used to be a book publicist and I miss it. It's so funny, we're on Zoom. So even though I know people can't see me, I just want you to imagine me holding up a book and Vanna Whiting the book. The American Way of Death by Jessica Mitford. Classic, amazing, morbid, investigative. It's almost like you did not ask me to just free associate. I'm just saying single words though for no reason.
Very effective.
I love
people in blurbs should do that. In fact.
Yeah, just good. Super good. They sure did print this. but no, it's a fantastic prism with which to see America and mortality. And there's nothing like it. It's just such a beautiful, beautiful book. I love The American Way of Death. I then have three darkly funny ones. One is Cassandra at the Wedding by Dorothy Baker, which is, have you read this?
Oh, I loved it.
Oh, it's so funny. It's so good. It has a killer first paragraph where you sort of look up and you go, damn, in abject jealousy. Also Muriel Spark, Loitering with Intent. That is the most recent read, which is a little bit embarrassing because I should have read it before now. And certainly for various reasons, should have read it before Cult Classic. But that's not bad if it's even, you know, 18th cousin removed of that book. And then I actually reviewed the following for the Times and just adored it. And I'm pretty sure I directly led to the following book getting the Nobel Prize. I don't see how that wouldn't be true. It's Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead. And Olga, it's really hard for me to say her last name, but it's Polish. Can you do it?
Starts with a K. I don't know.
It starts with a T. It's church. Charkotuk. I'm not going to do this. This is too humiliating. But I adored that book, and I have not read her next one yet. But it is on my nightstand. It is my nightstand. It's a very big book. But Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead. I just love that book, and it's, you know, a literary mystery, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Sloan, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is so fun. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.